You used to practice before fame and fortune came calling. He shrugged, ignoring the sting of her words. I did my time as a lowly associate, chased an ambulance or two, tried a little of this, a little of that. Little being the operative word, according to my ex-wife. She had to be the first lawyer's wife in history who actually wanted her husband to put in 80-hour weeks. Even now, he could hear Christine's criticism. It had worn a trench into the back of his mind like water running over stone. The years only made it deeper. Why can't you work harder? Why haven't you made junior partner? Why won't you join the family firm? You'll never amount to anything the way you bounce around. Well, you got her in the end, Ellen said. Justifiable homicide. An overworked young attorney is framed for the brutal murder of his scheming ex-wife. The book's dedication to Christine, who, I am pleased to say, will never get a dime of the royalties. A charming sentiment. And well deserved, I assure you. A wry smile twisted across his mouth. I thought you were unfamiliar with my work, Ms. North. I lied, Ellen said without remorse. I read the article in Newsweek. And what did you think? I think I made my opinion clear earlier. I don't like what you do. I present actual terrifying events to my readers in a way that can bring them to a deeper understanding of what happened, why it happened, how the justice system worked, or failed to work in some cases, he said. I give them insight. I give them closure. What's wrong with that? You're a mercenary profiteer who's no better than a vampire, a hack looking to steal the lives and pain of victims to compensate for a lack of any real imagination. You feed off people's fears and morbid curiosities and contribute to the nation's unhealthy obsession with sensationalism, Ellen countered. Don't try to put a noble face on it. You're in the entertainment business. Those were your own words. Everything I say can and will be used against me, he said dryly. Do you deny it? No. I'm not a journalist. People get their news from a paper or on TV. They don't fork over $20 in the bookstore for a hardback version of Time. People read true crime to escape. Same reason people read anything. And you don't find that just the least bit twisted? Escaping into someone else's real-life tragedy? No more so than picking up a Stephen King novel or an Agatha Christie mystery. To that reader, my book is just a story, something to get lost in and ponder, all the more interesting because it really happened. Ellen moved away from him then, shaking her head in disgust. Fine. You go talk to Hannah Garrison about what she's been through and what she's going through, and be sure to tell her it's just a story. That'll be such a comfort to her. Jay pursued her across the dusky room to the desk, automatically reacting to her righteous indignation. He was contrary by nature, born to take the opposite side just for the sake of a good argument. It wasn't anger that rushed to the fore. It was excitement, adrenaline. Hey, I can't change what's happened to make a story a story. It's there. It's happened. It's history. So you might as well make a buck off it? She pulled her jacket off the back of Franken's chair and slipped it on. If I don't, someone else will. Oh, well, that makes it all right. I didn't invent the game, counselor. No, but you're hell-bent on winning it, aren't you? Going straight to the top, dragging Glendenning into it. Of all the dirty... Not dirty, Jay clarified, wagging a finger in her face. That's hardball, and it's the way I play this game. I go after what I want, and I get it. The declaration hung in the air between them, a challenge that took on deeper nuances as Ellen stared up at him. He was standing too close again. She was leaning toward him. The scant few inches of air between them seemed to thicken, and a dormant sixth sense came to life inside her, rising to the surface like air bubbles in water. Awareness, not of an adversary in a duel of wits, but of something much more fundamental. I go after what I want, Ellen North. He whispered again, sliding a hand beneath her chin. His thumb brushed across the bow of her lower lip. And I get it," he breathed. "Remember that." "That you're ruthless?" Ellen murmured, telling herself to brand it into her mind. "Determined." Dangerous was the word she settled on. Dangerous to her in ways she had never anticipated a man could be. "Damn. I like the way you fight, counselor," he said softly. "How about that drink?" The invitation in his expression was far more intimate than an offered glass of brandy, that he could slide so easily from contention to seduction, as if it didn't matter what she thought of him, disturbed her. "Just because we disagree doesn't mean we can't be civil," he said. "I like you, Ellen. You're smart, sharp, not afraid to say what you mean." He chuckled. "I thought old Rudy was gonna have a stroke in your office, and you just stood there, cool as well water. What do you say we go find a nice quiet bar with a fireplace and argue the evening away?" He served the suggestion with a kind of smile that could have charmed nuns from their habits. This was why he was a celebrity, Ellen decided, instead of just a name on a dust jacket. The very air around him vibrated with sex appeal. "I don't think so, Mr. Brooks. It would be too much like fraternizing with the enemy," she said, stepping away from him, slipping her glasses on, shielding herself against his charm. "I'm not the enemy. I'm just an observer." "You may not be the enemy, but you're an enemy just the same. I can't differentiate between who you are and what you are, Mr. Brooks." She stared him straight in the face. "Maybe your conscience will let you exploit what's happened in this town. Or maybe you don't have a conscience. Either way, I won't condone it, and I don't want to be a part of it." With that, she walked out on him for the second time that day. Jay sat back against the judge's desk and gave a low whistle. He had had doors slammed in his face before. That was nothing new. It went with the territory. Sometimes people were willing to work on a story with him, and sometimes they weren't. If he wanted the story badly enough, and the front door closed, he went to the back. If the back door closed, he went in a window. If he couldn't get in through a window, he went in through the basement. If he wanted the story bad enough, he would get it. He didn't need Ellen North's cooperation. He could write this story from a dozen different angles. But he wanted Ellen North's cooperation. Hell, he wanted Ellen North. He knew better than to get involved with a source. Crossing that line was like walking into a nest of vipers, an invitation for disaster. He would compromise his credibility, color his perception of the story. As tough as he played this game, he played it by rules. He had already broken one, getting involved with a live case. That was just asking for trouble. Of course, as Uncle Hooter always said, he may not have looked for trouble, but when it came calling, he was never out of earshot. This case had grabbed him and hung on. He wanted inside of it, wanted to know why it had happened and what it had done to the people whose lives it had touched. He wanted to watch it all unfold. The trial, the strategy behind prosecution and defense, the reactions of the public as sides were taken. Something important was happening here. This wasn't just another crime. It was a crossroads, a crisis point for small-town America. He felt a need to capture that, and to distance himself from another crisis, he admitted in a shadowed corner of his mind, one he had turned away from before it could suck him in. This case was his focus. The trick was to get inside and yet maintain emotional distance. A tough call, when a part of him wanted no distance at all between himself and the prosecuting attorney. But then, it appeared Ellen North would maintain that distance for him. She was as unimpressed with his bag of tricks as a skeptic who had caught sight of the mirrors in a magic show. She didn't give a damn about the bankability of his name, would not have cared a lick that his latest work had been at the top of every bestseller list in the country for 3 solid months, or that Tom Cruise had signed on for the lead in the movie version of Justice for None. She didn't care who he was. She cared what he was. and she had made up her mind on that score right out of the box. The hell of it was, she was probably right. The hell of it was, he wanted her anyway. Chapter 8. Mitch slid in behind the wheel of his Explorer, bone-weary. The better part of the day had been spent overseeing the search for the missing gloves Garrett Wright had cast off during the chase the night of his arrest. Mitch's men, and the evidence techs from the BCA, had spent 2 days combing the ground the chase had covered through the woods of Quarry Hills Park, along the cross-country ski trail that ran the rim of the park behind the lakeside neighborhood, and into the yards of the homes that backed onto the park. 7 inches of fresh snow had fallen to cover the tracks from the chase, and every step taken by an officer or agent had the potential to further bury evidence that would not be seen again until April. They had gone over the ground with shovels and rakes, dug with garden tools in the areas too small for anything else. And still, in the end, it was dumb luck that did the trick. Lonnie Dietz had plunked down on a fallen log, tired and frustrated, and while he'd stared down at a crevice in the dead tree, something had caught his eye. A small slip of white. The size tag, sewn inside the cuff of a black leather glove. The gloves had been sent to the BCA lab in St. Paul. Then there had been the ever-present press to deal with, the mob of reporters already in a frenzy from the bond hearing. And constantly in the back of Mitch's mind were thoughts of Megan. She had been transferred to Hennepin County Medical Center in Minneapolis that morning and had gone into surgery for her hand at 3. He wanted to be there with her, but the case took precedence. Megan knew that. She had been the first to say it. She was a cop. She understood the priorities. She was a victim as well, which gave her an added motivation to want to see the investigation completed. She was also alone and afraid. The prognosis for her regaining full use of her hand was not good. If she couldn't use her right hand, she couldn't handle a gun. She couldn't defend herself. She couldn't return to the kind of duty that had been her whole life. All she had ever wanted was to be a good cop. And all Mitch wanted at the moment was to be able to hold her. He didn't relish the thought of an hour's drive to the cities, and guilt nipped him at the thought of leaving his daughter with her grandparents for yet another evening. But he started the engine and focused on Megan. The last thing he had expected to find in this nightmare of Josh Kirkwood's abduction was love, and he would never have expected love to come packaged in a tough Irish cop with a chip on her shoulder the size of Gibraltar. But there it was. He eased the truck out of his parking spot, fighting the urge to gun the engine and send the reporters who had followed him out scrambling for their lives. He waved them off, when he would rather have given them the finger, and pulled out onto Oslo Street. He was half a block from the interstate when his cellular phone trilled in his coat pocket. "Jesus, now what?" he muttered, pulling up to the curb. Leaving the engine running, he dug the phone out and unfolded it, telling himself it might be Megan or it might be Jesse calling to see where her daddy was. "Mitch Holt." The silence made him think the caller had given up while he had fumbled with his gloves in the pocket flap trying to get to the damn phone. But he hung on, an eerie sensation scratching through him. "Hello? Who's there?" The truck engine grumbled to itself. Outside, the shabby little neighborhood that backed onto the interstate was quiet in the twilight. People were in their homes, having supper, and watching the news, as night began to settle down around them. It was the time of night Josh had disappeared. As the thought shot a chill through him, the voice came over the phone. A whisper. "Ignorance is not innocence, but sin. Ignorance is not innocence, but sin. Ignorance is not innocence, but sin." The line went dead. Mitch sat perfectly still, his heart banging like a fist against his ribs. "Ignorance is not innocence, but sin." The message in the note that had been left behind at the scene of Josh's abduction. Common knowledge, he told himself, The press had splashed it all over. And yet he couldn't shake the sick sensation of dread. His muscles quivered with it. It steamed from his pores, even though the temperature in the cab of the truck was below freezing. The number of his cellular phone was not common knowledge. A minute passed, then five. The phone rang again, and the uneasiness pressed down on him like an anvil. "Mitch Holt." "Chief, it's Natalie. We just got a call from the sheriff. He's in Campion. They've got a child missing. And a note." Josh sat on the family room floor, cross-legged, staring at the flames in the fireplace. A giant sketch pad and a new box of markers lay on the floor beside him, untouched. Aladdin was running in the VCR, but the cartoon didn't interest him. His baby sister Lily, however, was delighted and toddled around the room, singing along, dancing with a stuffed Barney the dinosaur. Josh didn't care about cartoons anymore. He didn't want to play. He didn't want to talk. He stared at the fire and imagined he was a fireman on Mars, where it was hot all the time, and there were no kids. Hannah stepped down into the family room from the kitchen, rubbing lotion into her hands. The supper dishes were done, such as they were, glasses for soda and plates for pizza from the Leaning Tower of Pizza, Josh's favorite. Nutrition be damned tonight. She had called out for a medium pepperoni and mushroom and offered brownies for dessert. She hadn't made them either, selecting instead the best from the pans friends and neighbors and absolute strangers had sent over during the course of Josh's absence. She had brought her son home today, against Bob Ulrich's wishes, against the advice of the advocate from Park County Social Services. They had wanted to continue observation, as if Josh were a freak in a sideshow. But he had checked out all right physically, and Hannah had argued that his unwillingness to talk to anyone was no reason to keep him in a hospital bed. It was time to go home, where things were familiar and safe. She was a doctor herself. If Josh exhibited signs of physical problems, she would be the first to notice. And so they had come home, where reporters blocked the driveway, and well-meaning friends crowded the house. Home, where everything looked familiar, but nothing would ever be the same again. Hannah put the thought out of her head. She had sent the friends home, and the police had chased the reporters off the lawn. She had ordered pizza and built a fire and put one of Josh's favorite movies in the VCR. She had made things as normal as she could, considering the circumstances. Lily danced up to her, all smiles and rosy cheeks, and offered her Barney. Hannah scooped up her daughter instead and hugged her close.
"Mama, Josh!"
Lily announced, pointing at her brother. "Yep, Josh is home. We missed him, didn't we, Lilybug?"
"Josh! Josh! Josh!"
Lily sang, euphoric over her brother's return. At 18 months, she worshipped Josh. He had always been wonderful with her, sweet, gentle, loving. He read her bedtime stories and played with her. He hadn't spoken a word to her since coming home. He ignored her efforts to engage him in play. He looked through her, as if she weren't there. Fortunately, Lily was too excited to notice her brother wasn't returning her affections. It would have broken Hannah's heart if there had been any pieces left intact. She settled on the couch with the baby in her lap as the movie rolled to a close. Lily twisted around, blonde curls bouncing.
"More!"
"Let's ask Josh," Hannah said, her eyes on her son. "Josh, honey, do you want to run the movie again?" He didn't answer, didn't look at her. He sat as he had for the last hour, staring into the fire. He hadn't touched the sketch pad or markers. The advocate had said to keep them handy, to encourage Josh to draw, in the hopes that he would vent his experiences with his kidnappers through his artwork. So far, the only mark on the pad was the one the advocate herself had made, trying to draw Josh into a game of tic-tac-toe. Josh was keeping his experiences locked up tight, and his emotions along with them. Aside from his violent reaction to his father, he had reacted to nothing, and no one.
"More, more, Mama,"
Lily insisted. "Not tonight, sweetheart," Hannah murmured. It's time to watch something quiet, so we can all settle down for bedtime. Lily protested by taking Barney and moving to the love seat.
Where, Daddy?
Daddy's staying somewhere else tonight, Hannah answered, watching Josh for a reaction at mention of his father. There was none. She was angry with Paul for not being there, even though she really didn't want him. He had upset Josh before. She didn't want a repeat performance, nor did she want the tensions between her and Paul to be telegraphed to the children. Still, a foolish part of her wanted Paul to assert his rights as a father, to make some kind of stand to keep their marriage from disintegrating. She wanted to see the man she had married, the man she had loved. But he was lost. It seemed he had been an aberration, that for the first part of their marriage, Paul had been at his peak, and for reasons she couldn't understand, had slowly fallen backward, until she could no longer reach him, could hardly recognize who he was. It frightened her that she had thought she had known him so well, but now she didn't seem to know him at all. Sighing, she flipped through the television channels, looking for something without sex, violence, or reality involved, settling on an independent station out of Minneapolis that was running The Parent Trap for the millionth time. Haley Mills and a madcap adventure as twin sisters, classic fluff from the 60s, when the world had still clung to its last shreds of innocence. The 90s intruded immediately in the form of a news bulletin. A grim-faced anchorwoman with a helmet of spray-starched red hair filled half the screen, while the photograph of a little boy popped up in one corner under a red banner that proclaimed him missing. "Oh, my God," Hannah murmured. Authorities in the small Park County town of Campion tonight are launching a massive search for 8-year-old Dustin Holloman, abducted from a city park where he was playing with friends after school this afternoon. The abduction bears marked similarities to the case of Josh Kirkwood of Deer Lake, also in Park County. Josh, abducted January 12th, was returned to his family unharmed late last night. The family of Dustin Holloman can only hope for a similar outcome. Dustin is 8 years old, with blonde hair and blue eyes. He was last seen wearing blue jeans and a black and yellow ski jacket with an orange stocking cap. Anyone who thinks they may have information about Dustin is asked to immediately call the Park County Sheriff's Office. Josh turned slowly and looked at the television screen as it filled with a smiling, slightly blurry image of Dustin Holloman and the hotline phone numbers. He rose and moved to stand directly in front of the set in the Cherry Entertainment Center, staring without expression at the boy who had been proclaimed missing. "Josh," Hannah murmured, coming out of her seat, reaching for him. She dropped to her knees on the floor beside him. He stared at the little boy's photograph and lifted a finger to point at him. "Uh-oh," he said softly. "He's a goner." Chapter 9. "Will you disclose the contents of the note? How does this affect the case against Dr. Wright? Do you believe this is the work of the same kidnapper? Do you still believe Wright had an accomplice, or do you think you've got the wrong man sitting in jail? When will you release the contents of the note? How does this change your strategy?" The questions echoed through Ellen's head, swam through it, whirled around it. The faces of the reporters did the same. Some were familiar, some famous, many obscure. All of them wanted the same thing. The scoop, the hot quote, the exclusive tidbit. After 2 weeks of covering Josh Kirkwood's abduction, they came to Dustin Holloman's as ravenous as ever, driven by ambition to grab whatever details they could. "I'm ambitious," Adam Slater had proclaimed yesterday outside the hospital. She had spotted him in the sea of faces, out on the edge, on the fringe of the mob, his young eyes bright as he soaked it all in. Ambitious, or maybe desperate, was the word. Desperate for answers, desperate for some clue as to why the fabric of this quiet rural county was unraveling. That was what Ellen felt. A sharp, choking sense of desperation, the kind of panic that threatened to swell up and swallow her whole. It was just as strong now, as she pulled into her driveway, as it had been when she had driven away from the reporters in Campion. Campion was a farming community of 2,000, a simple, quiet place that made Deer Lake, a half-hour drive away, seem like a teeming metropolis, a town too small and too dull to need its own police department. It contracted with the county for the use of deputies to keep things in order. The people of Campion had watched the evening news when Josh Kirkwood had been taken and reflected that the world beyond them was an increasingly dangerous place. Thank God they lived in Campion, where everyone was safe. Until tonight. News that a child had been taken had the town reeling, stunned, and confused. It was deja vu for the volunteers who flocked over from Deer Lake. Having been through it all before, they organized search teams quickly and set up a command post in the Sons of Norway Hall, because it was the only place in town big enough. But, as had been the case 2 weeks before, there was little for the investigation to go on. Witnesses? Ellen hurried toward Mitch, turning her coat collar up against the bite of the wind. None, he answered, half shouting to be heard above the pounding of helicopter blades. State Patrol choppers had already begun their search, sweeping back and forth over the town in an ever-widening grid, while helicopters from the Twin Cities television stations hovered over the crime scene like vultures. Campion Civic Park had been turned into a surrealistic circus ground, the barren trees and deep snow cover illuminated by portable floodlights and the colored beacons of police vehicles. Yellow crime scene tape had been wound around saplings and fluttered in the sharp wind like banners around a used car lot. The boy's older brother was supposed to be watching him, Mitch said, as Ellen fell in step beside him. They were all skating on the outdoor rink over there. The older boys got a hockey game going, and the younger kids got pushed out. Apparently Dustin wandered away. He pulled a gloved hand out of his parka pocket and pushed back a lacework of small branches for Ellen to pass. Don't worry about where you're stepping, he said bitterly. The trail the boy took has already been tramped over by 60 or 70 sets of boots. They skidded down a short slope Ellen could easily envision as a favorite sledding spot for smaller kids. At the bottom, the woods of the park thinned out to brush. Beyond the brush, cop cars sat, strobes twirling, tossing discs of colored light across a winding back street where the nearest house was 300 yards away. Directly across the street from the park, the tumble-down remnants of what had once been farm buildings crouched, gray and bleak, open doorways and empty windows gaping like wounds, black with rot. Ellen's stomach clenched at the thought of being 8 years old, standing in this forlorn spot, knowing you were about to be taken by a stranger. If the kidnapper had been a stranger. They would have to question the Hollimans and the Kirkwoods, looking for any mutual acquaintances. Josh had not been taken by a stranger, provided Garrett Wright was the man who had taken him. She blew out a steamy breath as the doubts surfaced. She believed Wright was guilty, and even she was having second thoughts now. The press would have a field day casting doubt and muddying the waters of the potential jury pool. He said it was a game. Megan's words came back to her, bringing a chill that had nothing to do with a falling temperature. If this was all a game to him, then taking Dustin Holloman was a brilliant and ruthless move. In addition to raising questions in the press, the search for the second missing child would take priority and consume hours of manpower from two law enforcement agencies already investigating the Kirkwood kidnapping, the BCA and the Park County Sheriff's Department. The Deer Lake Police would be involved because of the possible connection to their own case. They would be forced to widen the investigation because of the involvement of a whole new group of people, the Hollimans and their friends and associates and enemies. In one move, their adversary had taken their team and scattered it all over the board. This is where they took off, Mitch said, flashing his badge at the deputies who stood wary watch around a naked sapling on the boulevard. Ellen let him herd her through the group to the center. Foreboding pressed down on her like a great weight. Tied around a branch of the tree was a bright purple scarf, crocheted by someone who loved Dustin. He had probably got it for Christmas, and had probably wished it were a Power Ranger toy instead. It fluttered on the branch, an oversized ribbon marking a terrible trail. and pinned to the scarf, was the note. But sad as angels for the good man's sin, weep to record and blush to give it in. Ellen shuddered. She couldn't get the sight of that scarf out of her mind. A small symbol of a small child snatched into a madman's game for a purpose known only to him. He said it was a game. But with what rules and what goal and what motivation? And what players? Virtually everyone in Deer Lake who had ever had a conversation with Garrett Wright had been questioned. His acquaintances were well-respected professional people, baffled by the turn of events that had landed him in jail. His students had rallied to support him. The faculty at Harris had nothing but respect for him. No one had uncovered or hinted at Garrett Wright being anything other than what he appeared. No secret taste for child pornography, no ties to the criminal underworld, no hidden life of satanic worship. As his wife had said, Garrett Wright didn't so much as speed in his perfectly sensible sob, let alone hang out with criminal types. There were precious few people on the list of Wright's known associates who looked even remotely like an accessory to kidnapping and assault. But someone had brought Josh Kirkwood home, and someone had taken Dustin Holloman away, and she was too damn tired to try to figure it out tonight. As Ellen reached toward the remote control for the garage door, something hit the driver's side window with all the force of a rock. Bolting sideways, a little shriek of surprise ripping up her throat, she twisted around wide-eyed to see J. Butler Brooks looking in at her.
You gonna sit here all night? Or put the car away and invite me in for coffee? I'm freezing my ass out here.
Ellen answered him with a scathing look. It was late, she was tired, and she still had work to do before she could lapse into unconsciousness for a few hours. But as she drove the Bonneville into her garage, he sauntered in beside her as if he had every right to be there. "Glendenning can't force me to be accommodating in my own home," Ellen said, hefting her briefcase out of the car. "As much as I may feel like one from time to time, I'm not a slave."
"I'll take that for you,"
Jay offered, reaching for the attaché. It was old leather that had taken a beating no live cow could have endured. The size of a small building, it looked as if she had packed it with granite blocks. "No, you won't," she said, and headed for the door that led directly into the house. Jay hopped up on the stoop beside her and held the storm door while she dug for her keys.
"Ellen, I'd like to talk to you."
"And I'd like to go to bed."
He leaned ahead, into her line of vision, and gave her a slow, sexy smile, glittering with humor.
"Can we talk afterward?"
Ellen told herself disgust was what made her fumble with her keys and drop them, not the mental image of J. Butler Brooks in her bed, wearing nothing but a sheet and that smile.
"I'm in no mood for sophomoric humor, and I've had my quota of arguments for the day," she said,
letting herself into the mudroom, where Harry lay curled up on his cedar-stuffed cushion. He boomed a bark of greeting and hopped to attention, his toenails tapping out Morse code on the vinyl flooring. Ellen gave the dog an absent pat, still scowling at the man who seemed bent on invading her life.
"Why don't you go back to wherever you came from?"
"I came from Campion,"
Jay said, smoothly stepping inside before she could close the door on him.
"You'd make a great Fuller Brush salesman,"
Ellen muttered, towing off her boots and setting them on the mat beside the door.
"Been there, done that."
He pulled off his gloves and stuffed them into his coat pockets.
"My respectable old Southern family ran out of respectable old Southern money long before I went to college."
He offered his hand to Harry. The golden retriever sniffed him, then slurped his big pink dog tongue along the back of Jay's knuckles. Ellen gave her pet a look that branded him a traitor and headed for the kitchen.
"So your morbid curiosity drove you to Campion," she said to Jay.
"I'm not surprised. The plot grows thicker for you.
Did you get a good close look at the boy's mother? I would suggest Kathy Bates to play her in the movie. I thought there was a strong resemblance, but then she was bawling her eyes out, so it's hard to say."
I didn't go near the woman.
Jay stopped in the doorway between the kitchen and dining room.
It makes me sick to think another child is going to suffer. I'm not a ghoul, Ellen, and I resent the insinuation.
She hefted her briefcase onto a cherrywood table with graceful Queen Anne legs, setting it down with a solid thud.
Tough. I didn't ask you to come here. I didn't ask you into my home, and frankly, I'm in no mood to play hostess.
I came to see how you were doing, he said. You've had a hell of a day.
He took in the dining room in a single look, mottled soft gold walls, decorated with brass sconces and primitive portraits of 18th-century people. Tasteful, simple, classy. The back wall was taken up by a bay window, the center section of which was a door that probably opened onto a deck or patio. Opposite the window, a railing ran some 8 or 10 feet, providing a graceful spot to look down on the living room below.
See how you've misjudged me?
He shuffled down the carpeted steps to the living room. With a flick of a switch, the brass table lamps filled the room with muted light.
I came here out of concern for you. I mean, we shared a bonding experience of sorts this afternoon, you and I. Trying to raise someone from the dead is a pretty intimate experience.
Yeah, we're practically blood brother and sister, Ellen said dryly.
She slipped her coat off and hung it on the back of a chair, her wary attention on the man who was intruding not only in her house, but in her case. He prowled her living room like a restless cat, running a hand over the furniture as if marking the territory.
And aside from your great concern for me, she said, descending the stairs, you had no intention of coming here to try for a little inside information on the kidnapping of Dustin Holloman?
I can get that information from other sources. Better sources, if you want the truth.
He flipped a brass-framed switch beside the fireplace, and flames instantly leaped to life around a stack of fake logs. Neat, clean, no muss, no fuss. He turned his back to the fire, pressing his hands against the screen to absorb the warmth that was real, even if the logs were not. Ellen stood across the room from him, beside a sturdy, overstuffed chair. She obviously hadn't made it home before being called to the crisis in Campion. She was still in the charcoal suit she had worn at Wright's bond hearing and Judge Franken's demise. Her hair had come down, pure, straight silk, that fell artlessly to brush the tops of her shoulders. Her veneer of makeup and manners had long since worn off. She looked exhausted and short-tempered, and utterly unapproachable. But even as he saw this, he could remember the way she had looked going into the command post in the Campion Sons of Norway Hall, shaken, afraid. Their bad guy had thrown them a wicked curveball, and no one had been ready for it.
The judge on your case dies on you. Another child is kidnapped while your bad guy sits in jail, he said, coming toward her slowly. That's a lot to deal with.
Yes, and now I have to deal with you, Ellen said, crossing her arms, wondering if you're committing my every word to memory or if you've got a tape recorder in your pocket.
You're damned suspicious.
I wouldn't trust you any farther than I could throw you.
After I came to check up on you and convince myself of your well-being?
Uh-huh,
she said with no conviction.
You can frisk me, if you'd like,
he offered in that dark, sexy tone.
But I'll warn you right now, that's not a tape recorder in my pocket.
I'll take your word for it. So now you've seen that I'm still in one piece.
She held her arms out from her sides to display the fact. You've done your good Samaritan deed for the decade. You're dismissed. Ignoring the suggestion that he had worn out his welcome, Jay sat down on the fat arm of the overstuffed chair. He could be as deliberately obtuse as a post. It was a skill that had served him well as an attorney, and more so as a writer. Persistence was the name of the game when it came to getting information.
Do you think it's part of Wright's plan?
He asked.
a diversionary tactic? I should have thought bringing back the Kirkwood kid accomplished that.
But it didn't spread out the defense, Ellen mumbled, more to herself than to Jay.
I don't follow.
A football analogy. I had a law professor who used to play for the Vikings.
Ah, I'm a baseball man myself.
The offensive team shows a formation that causes the defensive team to spread themselves all over the field, inevitably creating holes for the offense to slip through.
Involving a whole new set of victims in another town forces the investigation to broaden instead of focusing tightly on Wright and Wright's secret pal,
Jay deduced. He gave Ellen a nod.
Sharp thinking, counselor.
It's conjecture and speculation, she said as she went to the door. For all I know, the kidnapping of Dustin Holloman is unrelated to the kidnapping of Josh Kirkwood. He thought of what he'd seen and felt in Campion tonight. The sharp, metallic taste of fear. The sense that the place had somehow slipped into an alternate universe. Evil. It had been as much a presence as the police and the press. It seemed to permeate the night, dyeing it blacker, giving the wind a razor's edge, and fluttering brightly against it was a little boy's bright purple scarf, tied to the naked branch of a winter dead tree. He remembered thinking,
Jesus, Brooks, what have you walked into here?
More than he had bargained for.
I think we both know better, he said to Ellen, slowly pushing himself away from the chair. The question is, how will it affect the prosecution of Wright?
Ellen took a deep breath and let it out in a gust, leaning back against the wall, too worn out to keep herself upright. Look, you're right. It's been a long day, and I still have work to do, and there's no point in your staying because I'm not going to share anything with you.
Regarding the case, or you?
Either.
I just can't win with you, can I?
He pretended frustration, his brows tugging together. But as always, the wry amusement was there in his eyes. Ellen steeled herself against the effect. Not on your best day. Jay weighed the wisdom of trying to press for something more, but decided not to push his luck. He needed to win her over, not piss her off. He was already digging himself out of a hole after the Glendenning debacle, which he had to admit had been a major blunder on his part. Instead of smoothing the track for him, bringing in Glendenning had had the effect of throwing down a gauntlet. That's what he got for rushing into this thing. But he was in it now, a part of it. That had been the goal, to get inside. Good night, Mr. Brooks, she said, pulling the door open. He shoved his hands into his coat pockets and hunched his shoulders against the mere idea of cold, casting a longing look back toward the fire. The retriever lumbered down the stairs and sauntered past him, wagging his tail, but not pausing on his way to a warm spot in front of the hearth. The hominess of the scene gave him a little unexpected kick in a spot he would have sworn was tougher.
Well, he drawled, moving toward the open door. At least the dog likes me.
Don't make too much of it, Ellen advised. He drinks out of the toilet, too. He stopped in front of her, close enough that when she looked into his eyes, she thought she saw something old and sad, like regret. Foolish, she told herself. He wasn't the kind of man to have regrets. He went after what he wanted, and he got it, and she doubted he ever looked back.
Good night, Ellen,
he murmured, his tone as intimate as if they had known each other for a lifetime.
Get some rest. You've earned it.
With his eyes on hers, he leaned down and kissed her cheek. Not a quick, impersonal peck, but a soft, warm, intimate pressing of his lips against her skin, seducing her to turn toward him and invite the kiss to her lips. The idea sent quicksilver tremors through her and triggered a flood of forbidden questions. What would it be like to feel that incredible mouth of his? She slammed the mental door on the vision, bringing herself back to the moment, embarrassed that a simple kiss on the cheek could quicken her pulse and send her common sense spinning off its axis. The knowing look on Brooks's face was enough to make her want to slam the door on him.
"Sweet dreams, Ellen,"
he whispered, and sauntered out into the night. Ellen stood in the open doorway, hugging herself against the cold, as she watched him cross the street and climb into a dark Jeep Cherokee. The engine roared to life, and he was gone, though the uneasy restlessness he had awakened in her lingered. He kept her off balance, charming one minute, concerned the next, then seductive, then mercenary. Even the article she had read about him had alluded to contradictions within him that were not easily reconciled. She thought of Phoebe's assessment of his turbulent aura, hinting at inner turmoil and raw sexuality. She wondered who he really was, and told herself she didn't need to know. All she needed to know was not to trust him. Who can you trust? Trust no one. Trust no one. The idea made her feel hollow and ill. By nature, she wanted to trust. She wanted to feel safe. She wanted to believe those things were still possible. But the evidence didn't back her up. Another child was missing, and she was suddenly surrounded by people she didn't dare turn her back on. Brooks, Rudy, Glendenning, Garrett Wright. Judge Franken's death suddenly took on symbolic proportions. He was the last honorable man. He was justice, and his death was the death of an era. Good Lord, Ellen. She chastised herself for being melodramatic, but the fear remained within her that her world had changed, and there would be no going back. To distract herself, she stepped out onto the porch in her stocking feet to dig her mail out of the box that hung beside the door. Bills, sweepstakes, a month-late Christmas card from her sister Jill, more sweepstakes. Junk. She reached in once more, her fingertips brushing something that had got jammed down into the bottom of the box. Making a face, she twisted her hand in the narrow confines, just catching hold of the corner of the paper. She pulled it out, expecting yet another sale flyer. What she got stopped her heart cold. A crumpled slip of white paper with bold black print. "It ain't over till it's over." Chapter 10. He quotes Oliver Wendell Holmes, Robert Browning, William Blake, Thomas Campbell, and Yogi Berra? Cameron said, settling into a chair at the long table with a raisin bagel in one hand and a cup of Phoebe's Kona blend in the other. It doesn't follow. Has to be a copycat. At 8 a.m, the conference room was as cold as a meat locker. In a move of fiscal responsibility, the county commissioners had determined it unnecessary to keep the heat in the courthouse above 50 degrees at night. It took the building half the day to warm up. Everyone in the room had hands wrapped around a coffee mug. "Or one of Wright's supporters," Rudy offered. He had claimed the head of the table for his own. After spending 2 days in the wake of Bill Glendenning's powerful aura, he felt a rise in his own sense of power. He was in Glendenning's good graces, relatively safe on the sidelines of this case, and Victor Franken had finally croaked, obligingly vacating his seat on the bench. All may not have been right with the world, but Rudy Stovich didn't personally have a lot to complain about.
"It could have been one of Wright's students," Mitch said, his lack of inflection subtly giving away his doubts.
He had declined the offer of a chair, opting instead to slowly pace the length of the table. Operating on too little sleep and too much stress, he was fueling his system with high-test caffeine and sugar donuts.
"Ellen, you said you had a run-in yesterday with the sci-fi cowboys. What's your feeling?"
"I don't know," she said, picking at a blueberry muffin. She was exhausted. 2 nights, with a total of 8 hours sleep, left her feeling heavy and slow, as if the air around her was as dense as water. Yesterday's mail was on top of it in the box, so I'd say the note had to be there before 2 o'clock yesterday afternoon. She was repeating the theory she had told last night to one cop, and then another, and another. If it was one of the cowboys, they had to have run straight to my house after I saw them. My guys will be canvassing your neighbors this morning, asking if they saw anyone around your house yesterday. And they would probably learn nothing. Her neighbors were professional people, with daytime jobs downtown, or at Harris, or in Minneapolis. There was always the chance someone had been home with a flu that was going around and had glanced out the window at the right moment, but she felt no hope for that. What she felt was a sense of disquiet that had been lingering since Monday. Monday night kept coming back to her, waking suddenly, Harry growling, the silent phone call, then the call that Josh was home. She recited it all for Mitch, step by step, half embarrassed to be saying it at all. From an objective, rational perspective, nothing had happened. There had been no intruder in her home. The call had probably been a wrong number. But the timing of all that nothing made her uneasy. Mitch stopped his pacing and faced her, pressing his palms flat on the table. "Is your home number listed?" "Under my initials, E.E. North." "I got a call myself last night," he confessed. "On my cellular phone, a number only a few people have access to. The caller whispered, 'Ignorance is not innocence, but sin.' Right after he hung up, I got the word about the abduction in Campion." Rudy looked alarmed. "Are you saying this lunatic is someone you know?" "No." Mitch shook his head, his mouth twisting. "Our boy had the balls to call my mother-in-law and weasel the number out of her. I was just thinking, if he had to finagle Ellen's number out of someone, we'd have two people who might possibly be able to identify his voice." Cameron looked at Ellen with concern. "Why didn't you say anything about this call yesterday?" "I dismissed it as nerves. Josh came home. I'd been busy with a case. I didn't think about it again, until I found a note. Even now, I'm not sure it was anything. I mean, you're probably right. Yogi Berra is hardly Wright's style."
"But it might be his partner's style," Mitch argued. "Or it might be his idea of a joke. I'm no expert, but that note sure looked like the others."
"But the press made public the fact that the kidnapper's notes were on common 20-pound bond and came out of a laser printer," Cameron said, automatically playing devil's advocate. "Any nut with access to a laser printer could have done it."
"True. But the press didn't actually see the notes. The type font, the preference for lowercase letters."
He straightened away from the table, pulling his parka off the back of the chair where he had abandoned it earlier.
"We'll see what the lab boys have to say. In the meantime, we'll check with your neighbors," he said to Ellen. "One of them might have seen a kidnapper."
He didn't look as if he believed that any more than she did, Ellen thought. Hope had become a scarce commodity. "What's the latest word from Campion?"
"Help," he answered, shrugging into his coat. "They don't have a damn thing to go on. We've set up a multi-jurisdictional team of my people, guys from Steiger's office, and the BCA to work on connections. So far, there aren't any. The Hollimans don't know the Kirkwoods, Hannah isn't their doctor, Paul isn't their accountant, the boys have never met. Dustin and Josh share some physical traits. Light hair, blue eyes, same age. That would be more significant if this were a sexual predator thing, but it doesn't appear to be. It's some kind of goddamn chess game."
Rudy pushed his chair back and rose, hiking up his baggy suit pants by the belt.
"Be sure to keep us abreast of the developments, Mitch," he said importantly. "Yeah, I'll do that, if there are any. Ellen, I want you to call the department if you have any more odd happenings. It may be our boy or not. Wright has a lot of supporters. They may not all confine their anger to the picket line in front of the courthouse. You're a likely target."
"Thanks for reminding me," Ellen said sardonically, then remembered Megan. Megan, who was lying in a hospital bed because of this case. She could have as easily been dead. If the note had come from Wright's accomplice, then that could mean she had been singled out for inclusion in the game, as Megan had been singled out.
"Did anyone tell you Karen Wright went home yesterday?"
Mitch asked, backing toward the door.
"Home, as in down the block from the Kirkwoods?"
Cameron said, appalled.
"It's the only home she's got," Mitch said. "The BCA was through with the place, and the city council was making noise about the cost of putting her up at the Fontaine, so we took her home."
What about the accomplice? Cameron asked. If Karen knows something, she could be in danger.
The BCA has a man on her. We should be so lucky that this creep is stupid enough to come calling.
I'm concerned with her mental health, Ellen said. Is she staying alone?
She has friends looking in on her. And Teresa McGuire, the victim witness coordinator, is checking on her and reporting back to my office. Still hoping she'll turn on right?
She might have an attack of conscience.
I wouldn't count on it, Counselor. Denial is pretty tough armor.
Cameron turned to Rudy as Mitch made his exit, and Ellen stuck her head out the door to call for more coffee. Any word on who'll get the case with Franken gone?
None yet. They may delay the whole thing until a replacement is named, Rudy said, then frowned, worrying suddenly that his connection to this case, as much as he had tried to minimize it, would somehow jeopardize his chances for appointment to Franken's seat.
If that happens, we can count on Wright's lawyer raising a stink, Ellen said. She walked back along the length of the table slowly, her eyes scanning the mountains of paperwork the case had already generated. Piles of statements, search warrants, arrest warrants, police reports. She and Cameron had commandeered this conference room for their own war room, where they could lay everything out and study it. A replica of the timeline in the law enforcement center was taped to one peeling, dark salmon wall. Lying across a stack of news clippings was the Morning Star Tribune open to a photo of J. Butler Brooks, scowling at the camera. The headline read, "Crime Boss Fights to Save Judge." Ellen tossed it onto the credenza. Behind it, dusty, hot air from the vents blew straight up along the old window, where 80% of the heat escaped through the glass. "By law, Wright is entitled to that hearing without delay," she said. "I bet they'll divvy up Judge Franken's caseload between Witt and Grabko and float another judge in here to catch the overflow until the governor names a replacement." Rudy breathed a sigh of relief. "Who is Wright's attorney now?"
Cameron shrugged. Ellen shook her head. "I'm going to see Dennis later. Maybe he'll know something we don't."
"You can bet he knows something we don't," Cameron said darkly. "Rumor has it he had a long talk with his client after the bond hearing yesterday, and that he left the jail looking sick."
"He'd just lost a client and a chance for a lot of publicity," Rudy pointed out.
Cameron reserved comment, his gaze steady on Ellen.
"I'll find out what I can," she said. "But how much can he tell me without committing a breach of ethics?"
"How much can he keep to himself without committing a breach of decency?"
"Let me know what you find out," Rudy instructed. "Where do we stand as far as ammunition for this hearing?"
"We've got the statements from Mitch and from Megan O'Malley regarding her abduction and that whole drama," Cameron said. "We won't have the DNA results back on the bloody sheet Wright wrapped around her that night, but we've already got the blood types, one of which is the same as O'Malley's, and one of which is the same as Josh's."
"Regarding O'Malley's situation," Ellen said, "as you know, Wright was apprehended fleeing the scene. To paraphrase Megan, we've got him dead to rights."
"But what about the boys' case? So far, we've got a victim who's not talking."
"We've got Ruth Cooper, the witness who identified Wright in the lineup as being the man she saw on Ryan's Bay the day Josh Kirkwood's jacket was found," Cameron said.
Rudy made a rumbling sound in his throat that might have been discontent or phlegm.
"I was there. The lineup was wearing parkas and sunglasses. A good defense attorney is going to take it apart like Tinker Toys."
"The visual may be iffy," Ellen conceded. "But you'll remember, Mrs. Cooper also made a voice ID. The two together will be hard to discount."
"We've also got Agent O'Malley's testimony as to what Wright confessed to her regarding Josh," Cameron pointed out.
"He said, she said," Rudy grumbled.
"She's a police officer."
"She's a victim, hardly an impartial hearsay witness."
Ellen tipped her head. "Maybe, maybe not. I think her credentials will carry her through."
"Wright knows the Kirkwood family," Cameron went on, "and he has a flimsy alibi for the time Josh disappeared. He claims he was at his office working that night, but so far that's just his say-so."
"So what's his motive?" Rudy asked.
"We don't have one, other than that he's playing some kind of sick game," Ellen said. All we have to do for the moment is get him bound over. We don't need a motive until trial. We have to bear in mind that Wright wasn't even a suspect until Saturday night. The investigation is really just beginning. Rudy ambled to the window and looked down on the early shift of protesters gathering on the sidewalk.
"It sounds like you've got everything under control, Ellen," he said, glancing at her from the corner of his eye.
Rumors had been churning for months that the yuppies of Park County were looking to root him out of office and replace him with Ellen North. When he moved into Franken's seat, the path would be clear for her. She and her backers likely saw this case as her chance to step into the limelight. But limelight wouldn't be the only thing she would step in. He pulled in a deep, cleansing breath and envisioned his judgeship so close he could feel his new black robes draping over him.
"You know, I'm just an old country lawyer at heart," he said. "When I came on this job, there was no such thing as a high-profile case. Folks around here didn't lock their doors. They let their kids run all over town without worrying about them. Deer Lake was the kind of town America is supposed to be all about."
Ellen recognized the speech immediately. He had used it as his closing statement in a drug dealer's trial 18 months ago. He heaved an exaggerated sigh and twisted his features into the expression of a sad clown.
"Do your best, Ellen," he instructed. "Always let your constituents know you did your best."
"Rudy, I've told you 100 times. I have no intention of running for your office." And for the 101st time, he didn't listen. The irony was too much. Her ambition topped out right where she was. She had no political aspirations, had thought leaving Hennepin County had been a clear statement to that effect. Yet, in the place she had come to settle herself into a comfortable niche, she was constantly viewed with suspicious eyes as being an ambitious woman with her sights on bigger things.
"Yes, well," he said, sauntering away.
As he opened the door, Phoebe popped in, coffee pot in hand.
"Garrett Wright has a new attorney!"
Her face glowed with the excitement of it all. She set the coffee pot on the table, unable to give the announcement adequate fanfare without using her hands.
"A big, big shot," she said,
bracelets rattling.
"Anthony Costello!"
Cameron gave a low whistle.
"Wow! Where'd Wright get that kind of money? Costello's retainer is more than a professor at Harris makes in a year." "That was my question, too," Phoebe said,
sliding into the chair next to him, settling in for a round of juicy speculation.
"It doesn't matter who his lawyer is."
Rudy spouted false confidence like a fountain, the promise of his judgeship making him magnanimous.
"We've got the team to beat him. Isn't that right, Ellen?" "Ellen?"
Ellen jerked her head in Rudy's direction, feeling faint.
"Yes, of course."
Her voice sounded far away to her, as if it had come from someone out in the hall. Her hands were curled over the back of a chair, fingertips digging into the upholstery.
"Wright can bring in his big-shot lawyer from the cities. We've got Ellen,"
Rudy declared as he marched off down the hall, thanking God he had dropped this hot potato in Ellen North's lap.
"Did you ever come up against Costello when you were with Hennepin County?"
Cameron asked. "A few times." She imagined, if she was to look in a mirror, her reflection would be pale and wide-eyed, but neither Phoebe nor Cameron seemed to notice anything odd about her appearance or her manner. She pulled out the chair and slid into it. Her body seemed to be working independently of her mind, and thank God for that. In her mind, she was floundering, scrambling, knocked off balance by a blindside shot. Tony Costello's was not a name she had ever expected to hear in these offices. He was big money, style and flash, one of the top defense attorneys in the Twin Cities, and rapidly making a name for himself on a larger scale. Which was, of course, what he would be doing with Garrett Wright. Soaking up publicity like a sponge, posing for the cameras, and preaching his propaganda of justice for the common man. That was why he had taken Garrett Wright's case, Ellen told herself. It had nothing to do with the fact that she was the prosecutor. And it certainly had nothing to do with the fact that they had once been lovers.
Garrett Wright couldn't have known anything about her past with Tony Costello. It was just a coincidence that he had chosen the one defense attorney in the state who knew her better than any other, the one who had slipped under her guard and stabbed her in the back. Even as she tried to placate herself, the tide of the uneasiness that had been with her since Monday night rose a little higher inside her.
"We've calculated all the moves, all the options, all the possibilities,"
Garrett Wright had whispered.